So anyway, thing I was assigned to talk about is what you might call a few topics, but one of them is non-food chametz. And that would include things like medicines, cosmetics, deodorant, toothpaste, mouthwash, all of that, all of the stuff that you don't eat for a meal. Now, all of us know, of course, let me just start off with a general perspective that I'm sure was spoken about. The central idea of Pesach is, of course, chametz no good, matzah good, right? That's the basic idea. And what is chametz? So chametz is any, it has to be five grains. That's wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. Those are the only five things that become chametz. And when they come in contact with water, and they are left with water 18 minutes without baking, they undergo a process of fermentation. And when they have that requisite fermentation, which is only after 18 minutes or more, they become something that is forbidden to eat and even own on Pesach, because that is called chametz. Now again, I emphasize, chametz under Torah law only applies to the five species of grain. So actually, maybe I'll start with my second topic first, just an introduction. That means, under Torah law, a whole bunch of things are not chametz. Rice is not chametz under Torah law. Again, please underline under Torah law as I talk. Corn is not chametz under Torah law. Soybeans are not chametz under Torah law, because under Torah law, it is only the five species of grain. Corn is not a species of the five grains, nor is rice. However, there is a longstanding custom, and this is maybe one of the most major differences between Ashkenazim and Sfardim. Okay, Ashkenazim, as you already know, this is not a Hasidic, non-Hasidic differentiation. This is an Ashkenazic Sephardic. There's another minhag that is Hasidim and non-Hasidim I'll get to. And that is Sephardic Jews are Jews from Spain, North Africa, and countries like Syria and the like, mainly Islamic countries. And Sephardim do have a tradition, although there are variations even within Sephardim, that they are allowed to eat corn and rice because they follow the original halacha. The original halacha is chametz, and all of this stuff is not chametz, right? So that's what Sephardim does. It's very logical. But Ashkenazim have a custom that goes back to the 1200s, very early already, so it's not a recent custom, that any type of legume is a bean, that includes peas, string beans, soybeans. Well, that's a good question. Why? Coffee beans we do have, but edible beans that you eat as food, and also including rice and corn, are not eaten on Pesach by Ashkenazim, and that is because they are called kitlias. Kitlias just means beans, and it's a bit of a mystery. Why on earth did they prohibit kitlias? So there are two different reasons that are given in the classical sources why there became such a custom called not eating kitnios. Reason number one is a lot of types of kitnios were commonly ground into flour. Rice is ground into flour. Corn was ground into flour. So consequently, if people would see you baking with rice flour or corn flour, they might think you're actually baking with wheat flour or rye flour. So it's kind of what we call a gezeira, a fence, that in order that people shouldn't think you're baking with actual chametz, you know, you don't use anything that's that could be made into a flour. That's one reason. Well, it's even less than rabbinical in a sense, because when we talk about something rabbinical, we are normally referring to a ruling that's in the Talmud. Kitnios is not even in the Talmud. Kitnios dates from the 13th century. So it would have the status of a rabbinically mandated custom. But it is an important custom. You can't just break these customs because you don't like them and the like. Now, if you married a Sephardic gentleman, you would be permitted to eat kitnios.
Why did they take that on?
Well, I said it was taken on because, number one, kitnios types products were commonly ground into flour, and therefore observers would confuse them with grain flour.
But why was it so much later?
Huh?
Why was it so much later?
In other words, why wasn't it originally? Well, again, the rabbis in different generations identified problems that they actually saw. In fact, there's actually a story that was recorded. Well, actually, that's more connected to Kibbutz. So I'll get to that. But basically, the fact that in a later time, rabbis saw a need for certain stringencies is not necessarily a question, why didn't they see it earlier? In other words, at different times in our history, there are different problems that arise that need to be addressed. So because of this, we Ashkenazim have a whole category of products on Pesach that we are not allowed to eat, that Sfardim are allowed to eat. And that's why in Israel, if you follow things very carefully, you will notice many products have very good supervision for Pesach. But it will say, Kasher lePesach liochlei kitniyot. It is kosher on Pesach for those who eat kitniyot. Now, when you see, meaning Sephardim, meaning when you see that and you're Ashkenazic, can't buy it. If you're Sephardic, you can buy it. In fact, it's very interesting. Popcorn is kitniyos. So theoretically, Sephardim could eat popcorn on Pesach. In fact, somebody once wrote an article about they went to a movie on Chol HaMoed, and they saw a kid selling popcorn in the movie theater during Chol HaMoed. So the person was very disappointed. I mean, on Pesach they sell popcorn, and then she overheard that when somebody wanted to buy popcorn, the kid asked, "Are you Ashkenazi or Sephardi? Because if you're Ashkenazi, I'm not allowed to sell it to you." So he said, in Israel, even the movie theater popcorn, you know, has these halachic questions.
Yeah. Halachic, it's a halachic issue even selling? Hametz,
well, in an indirect way it is, because one Jew is not allowed to cause another Jew to sell. So it's not like the Sephardi is committing a sin by selling, but he would be committing a sin by selling it to an Ashkenazi, because it would be the same as I would sell you something not kosher. I'm not allowed to cause you to sin.
This is more general, but when the reason for a rabbinical stringency falls, why do we still keep the stringencies when there's reason for it?
Yeah, that is a very, very excellent question. Now, first of all, though, I'm not so sure why you've concluded that the reason doesn't apply anymore. Your question is a very good question, but I'm not sure that you've shown any reason that it would apply in this case. But your question is an absolutely good question. I mean, for example, I'll give you an example where it is definitively a good question. That is, you know, you may have learned in your Hilchos Shabbos that you're not allowed, if you have a minor headache, it's not a migraine, you're not supposed to take aspirin on Shabbos for minor illnesses. And the reason is because we're afraid you would go out and ground up a plant to make medicine for yourself. And therefore, the rabbis say, don't take the pill lest you make the pill. Now, as far as I know, I don't even know what an aspirin plant looks like. You know, and I think most of us would conclude that the reason for that enactment does not apply in an era of drugstores and pharmacies and everything else. So that would be one example where you have this rabbinic law, don't do A because you might do B, when it's pretty clear nobody's going to do B anymore. Another example might be, do you know that on Shabbos you're not allowed to go swimming? And the reason is because you might construct a raft by taking different pieces of wood and tying them together. Well, again, most of us are not going to, you know, build a raft in that way. So you're raising a very, very good question, and that is, when the rabbis prohibit a practice because of a certain concern, and we are empirically pretty certain that that concern doesn't apply anymore, what effect does that have on the rabbinic law? Now, you raised it by kitnius, but my response to kitnius is that some of the confusion could still exist even today, so I wouldn't negate it. But your question, that doesn't take away from your question. So, or I'll give you a third example. Do you know there's a law in the Gemara that says that if you left water uncovered or any liquid uncovered and you were not in the room, even for a short time, liquids cannot be drunk if they were left uncovered? Now, the reason for that is a strange reason, because maybe a snake snuck in and took a little sip while you weren't around, and the snake may have left his venom in the liquid, and the venom might not be visible, and if you drink the liquid, you might be poisoning yourself with snake venom. Now, people say, oh, well, today this is not going to happen. By the way, it's interesting that we actually have some evidence that today it can happen, particularly in the Middle East. But okay. But so the short answer is that there actually is a big argument among the great poskim on this. Some poskim take the idea, the spiritual idea, that the rabbis enact these laws with a certain type of divine inspiration. And by that I mean, so even if the conscious reason that comes to their mind might not be a reason that applies today, it was Hashem's will for a gazillion other reasons that perhaps were not even appreciated by the rabbis themselves. Interestingly enough, it's like a prophet. A prophet does not always fully understand the full repercussions of their prophecy. In a sense, the rabbinic enactments may work the same way. So in a sense, once it's made, you know, it becomes part of the halacha. But again, your question is a very good question, because we do have some other cases where we, in other words, if you surveyed all of halachic literature and made a list, you would find sometimes we say, oh, reason doesn't apply, therefore law doesn't apply. Other times we say, even if reason doesn't apply, law does apply. And you're sometimes hard-pressed. Now, let me give you another example. Chalav Yisrael is a very good example. I know in Chabad, Chalav Yisrael is a very important thing, but Chalav Yisrael was not invented by Chabad. Chalav Yisrael is a law in the Mishnah. Now, what does Chalav Yisrael mean? Chalav Yisrael means that a Jew is only allowed, according to the Mishnah, a Jew is only allowed to drink milk or dairy products if there was a Jew that saw the milking. If a Jew didn't see the milking, you don't need a Jew to milk it. You don't need a Jew to do the milking, but you need a Jew to see the milking. If a Jew did not see the milking, that milk is treif. Now, what is the reason for Chalav Yisrael? Not the Kabbalistic reason, but the halachic reason. Because we are afraid if a Jew did not watch the milking, what would happen is maybe the non-Jew adulterated the milk with pig milk or camel milk, which actually done. It's done in you know, countries. Non-kosher milk, donkey milk. Although I did read, this is very strange, that donkey milk is actually the most, there's a market in donkey milk. Donkey milk is the most expensive milk in the world. Cleopatra, it's very good for skin. Cleopatra took a daily bath in donkey milk.
She died?
She had to. You needed. No, this is the thing. Donkeys produce very little milk. So she needed like 200 donkeys to be milked per bath. Okay. Again, I just for some reason I had a morbid curiosity about this the other day, and I was just looking around. But the thing is this: so Rav Moshe Feinstein has the following psak, and this ties in directly to your question. He says that since today, if a farmer were to adulterate his milk, cow milk, with milk of another species, he could be fined and put out of business and arrested. You don't need Chalav Yisrael. This is Rav Moshe. Now, again, Chabad doesn't hold this. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, although he encourages Chalav Yisrael, but he says Chalav Yisrael is not mandatory because the reason for needing Chalav Yisrael does not apply in a society that punishes people for adulteration. Now, when you're in Mongolia or Afghanistan, you have to have Chalav Yisrael because maybe they'll mix it with camel milk and yak milk and llama milk and everything else. But in a country like an industrialized country like America, or you know, U.S., Canada, England, you know, countries that have supervision of food, now that's an example, is it not, of where if the reason doesn't apply, you know, the halacha changes. Now, on the other hand, let me point out, a lot of people argue with Rav Moshe Feinstein. For example, Chabad argues, other people as well, because they say, hey, the halacha is the halacha. We can't start saying it doesn't apply. So your question is a very, very excellent question. And all I'm giving you is I'm giving you examples that move in different directions. Yeah.
I have a question on that. Wasn't Rav Moshe's psak, wasn't that a heter in a certain circumstance?
Well, this is what people want to say after the fact. Again, let me emphasize, Rav Moshe absolutely encouraged Chalav Yisrael, and Rav Moshe himself did not have something that wasn't Chalav Yisrael his whole life. His whole life he kept Chalav Yisrael. So Rav Moshe was lenient because this involved a school which would have been a big financial expenditure. But again, the logic of his psak would apply to every case, even if the particular psak was limited to that case, but he gave a certain logic and framework which would apply everywhere. Yeah.
I have two questions. Why is OU, like in the States, like OU milk?
Yeah.
Why is that? It's not halal kosher.
That's correct. Well, the reason is following. The reason is because the OU, for example, relies on the psak of Reb Moshe Feinstein. That's exactly the issue. That's why a chassid or a follower of Chalav Yisrael would not use an OU dairy product. That's exactly the case. But once again, I can't call that treif because they are following a decision of a great gadol, right? So even if I wouldn't eat it or you wouldn't eat it, but it's not, you can't call it treif in any possible. But that's exactly right. The OU follows the decision of Rev Feinstein for this.
Yeah. My second question is, what if kidneys is because people made flour from these legumes and things like that?
Yeah.
Why is potato flour and things like that?
So that's an excellent question. There actually was a discussion around 250 years ago whether potatoes should be declared kidneys. Now, it was decided. Now, this is interesting. Now, today, there's all sorts of prepared Pesach food, although even today a lot of people don't use it. But you know, in Europe, the Europe of your parents, if your parents come from Europe and ask them what they ate on Pesach, they ate potatoes, meaning to say, if you were to forbid potatoes on Pesach, people would starve to death, more or less. You may remember in the 1830s, it sounds like a joke, but there was a big potato famine in Ireland, the Irish potato famine. And so you start laughing, potato famine, big deal, they didn't have chips, you know. Potatoes was such a staple of the diet that thousands and thousands of Irish died of starvation, and that's why so many came to America, because of the potato famine. Well, in Eastern Europe, potatoes were very, very similar staple. So this is an example where even though the logic of the enactment should apply, but the hardship would have been so severe that the rabbis decided we are not going to extend the rabbinic enactment to situations of great starvation.
Well, that logic, what about people in Asia can eat rice?
Well, again, let me point out, you're actually there happens to be not a lot of Jews in, other than Chabad Shuluchim, there happens to be not a lot of Jews in Asia. But, you are correct. There were various times where there were famines and other foods were not available, and rabbis permitted kidneys. In other words, that's exactly the point. That kidneys, of course, if it's really a matter of life and death, you can even eat chametz, I understand. But kidneys is more flexible than chametz. In other words, we would permit chametz. For example, you can give children, let's say a child has a wheat allergy, and the only thing a child can drink is soy formula or rice formula, or rice cereal. So even though you're Ashkenazi and it's kidneys, you're allowed to feed kidneys to children if they don't tolerate other foods well, because we don't want to make it too hard for them. Now, the only thing is, since for the adult, kidneys is not kosher, so you have to prepare it in separate utensils, like you should have a separate plastic bowl or something. You shouldn't make rice cereal in your kosher LePesach regular dishes, but kids can have kidneys if that's necessary and the like. So it's a flexible rule. Let me point out, too, that there's a big, big argument. Now, you're not old enough to remember all this or to have seen this, whether kidneys only applies to the actual legume or it applies to the oil. For example, peanuts are considered to be kidneyish. You can't eat peanuts on Pesach. Although it's interesting, that's the only nut that's kidneyish. You can eat almonds, you can eat cashews, but peanuts, for whatever reason, was included in kidneyish.
Peanuts are legumes.
Yes, because they are legumes. They grow from the ground. The other ones grow on trees.
Yeah.
That's correct.
I'm allergic to peanuts and legumes.
Okay. So.
But not.
So kidney.
Not.
All right. So kidneyish works good for you.
Yeah.
Well, rice. Okay, rice. Okay. But
are
you got it. Yeah, I'll talk about that
okay.
in a moment. I'll talk about quinoa in a second. Now, peanuts are considered kidneys because they are legumes. But there are some opinions that say that if it is peanut oil or soy oil or cottonseed oil that it is permitted to use on Pesach.
Really?
Because we only make the gezeira, we only make the decree on the actual thing and not on the oil, etc. Some say corn oil, some would allow corn oil. Now, the prevailing custom is to be strict on these matters. So what do they use? So on Pesach, the kosher Pesach oil tends to be olive oil or something like that. But I do remember my own childhood. I do remember X number of years ago. I don't want to say how many years ago, but X number. I thought you were trying to say, well, damn, okay. no, but the thing is that I do remember as a kid that peanut oil used to be certified kosher Pesach.
For real?
And now you will not see it certified. Cottonseed oil, although this is very inferior oil, was commonly used for Pesach, and now it's no longer certified.
Cottonseed
oil was used for Pesach. But so this is called shemen kitnios, the oil of kitnios. Soy oil, according to that opinion, would be permitted, but the modern tendency has been to be stricter in this area. So you're not going to see it anymore. Maybe some people might.
Why is cotton seed not used?
Well, because cotton seed was considered to be a kidneys, a type of legume growing from the ground or whatever. Yeah.
I'm confused, though, because I thought that not eating kidneys is a minhag.
Yeah.
It's a minhag, so how are you saying that the boy that would have sold it, another boy he was doing an aver from selling it to him, it's a minhag, it's not halakha.
No. Well, but again, minhag can become a halacha when it's been accepted by a segment of the Jewish people. It is halacha now, absolutely. I want to make it clear. In Israel, there's a bit of a movement among some segments of the religious community to say you don't have to keep kitnios anymore. Some dati liumi groupings, religious Zionists, some, most not, but some are saying kitniot is a galut minhag. It is a minhag of the galut, of the diaspora. Now that we're in Israel, you know, let's go back to the Torah. You don't need kitniot. But that's not correct. Again, if you're Sephardic, by all means, you are 1,000% permitted to eat kitniot. But if you're Ashkenazic, you are not allowed to eat kitniot. It's absolutely a halacha. But as I say, we have leniencies for children, and the like, and there's no issue to own kitnios, so you can keep it in your house to give to your child or whatever. You don't even have to sell it, but you should not eat it, and even if you make it for your children, you should make it in a separate pot, a separate utensil. You should not use your kosher LePesach things.
What about Sephardi Hasidim?
It depends when they became. What were they first? I assume they were first Sephardim who became Hasidim. Yeah, so it really depends on what they accept. Well, the question becomes this. Let's say you have a mixed marriage. Right? Ashkenazic husband, Sephardi wife. So here we have a general rule, as you know, that generally speaking, wives assume the customs of the husbands. So that means an Ashkenazi woman who marries a Sephardi man is allowed not only to make kitnios, but to eat kitnios, and their children would follow all of that. On the other hand, that would also mean that a Sephardic woman who marries an Ashkenazi man would actually be forbidden to eat kitnios. But in there, we have a certain way out. If the husband gives her permission, so to speak, he can let her hold on to that custom, but she wouldn't be allowed to give him kitnios, right? She can't. Give him permission to keep kidneys, to get rid of kidneys. Yeah.
Aren't you not allowed to go down on a stringency? So if you marry someone, if you marry someone Sephardi and you're going down on a stringency,
yeah, but I understand. But this, you know, we don't really call it going down. We simply say for Sephardim this is fine, for Ashkenazim it's not fine. So you're now Sephardic, you know. So it's not really going down. It's just you're becoming part of a different culture. Yeah.
If when you get married and the woman has more of an attachment to a certain minchah than the man does, you decide together which minchah you're keeping?
There's a big problem. In other words, on one hand, it is absolutely true that the husband could agree to let the wife keep the minhagim that she's attached to. But he really should not take on new customs. So you could have a difference in that. in that particular. Certainly, if an Ashkenazi man marries a Sephardi woman, there's no way he would be permitted to have kitnias. That would be a very severe, severe thing.
Yeah, that's my dad. My dad. I mean, obviously, my family's not observant, but like my dad, growing up when we kept Pesach, he always ate whatever my mom cooked, and my mom's Yemenite.
Yeah.
So if she cooked rice, we ate rice. And okay. He's Ashkenaz. You know what I mean?
So he's a really good husband. He just eats whatever
yeah.
whatever he's given.
Divorce,
that's good.
But yeah.
All right.
And he doesn't
pay attention.
So.
All right. Okay. Mirtz Hashem.
Yeah.
Huh?
What about
so canola oil again? This was the same machlokas. Canola oil is made from what is called rapeseed. Rapeseed is like a certain type of seed, and rapeseed is considered to be kidneys. And consequently, I believe canola oil is no longer certified. You know, when peanut oil used to be certified, canola oil was certified. I believe they don't do it anymore. So I'm going to check. I believe that you can get grape seed oil. Grapes are not classified as kidneys. Grape seed oil. And but what is vegetable oil? Yeah. So usually it's soy or corn. So that's kidneys. So the vegetable oil of Pesach will either be olive oil, or it will be grape seed oil, which is an interesting taste. And that's what you get. Canola oil is gets us into that controversy. And as I say, 20 years ago, it would have been common. Today, it's less common. Things are getting driven out of the market. Now, quinoa is an interesting example of... The question here is an interesting conceptual question. Should kidneys be expanded to embrace newly discovered types of products? For example, now quinoa is spelt Q-U-I-N-O-A, quinoa.
A few years ago,
yeah.
It was okay.
Well, okay, so let me give you a little history of this. It's a little crazy. And when we talk about the proverbial two Jews, five opinions, quinoa is a very good example of this. Quinoa was an unknown grain in most of the world. It certainly was not known in Eastern Europe.
Isn't it a grass?
Yeah, it's not really. I'm using grain in a lobzop. Quinoa is a grass, but it's from South America, from the Andes, and the Incas used it, and the Mayas used it, and the Aztecs used it. And it tastes very much like grain. It tastes like grain. Buckwheat is also not a grain. Buckwheat is the same thing. Buckwheat is kidneys. That's why you can't have kasha.
Is that what we're going to talk about, the whole class, what's kidneys?
No, no, I have some other topics too.
Okay.
But
No,
I have other things. Okay, I have other topics too, but I'm doing kidneys first. Quinoa was just discovered for Western consumption, maybe 20 years ago, whatever it is, and the question immediately becomes, well, it's not one of the five species of grain, but should we make it kidneys? So many opinions said, hey, kidneys is what it was. You don't kind of enlarge it. It's one thing. The whole thing was only a minhag to start off with, so you don't go beyond the parameters of the original minhag, although I have a kasha on that, because corn was also unknown in Europe. And yet corn is kidneys, so you do see a certain enlargement. And potatoes is new also. Potatoes is from the Americas. In the 1200s, in medieval Europe, potatoes were unknown.
Yep.
Potatoes come from North America, as does
not
corn.
Ireland.
Not Ireland. No. It came from America to Europe, actually. It's interesting. So the Star K is a very respected certifying organization in Baltimore. In fact, the head of the Star K was my...
It's a headship.
Yes. He was my my teacher in high school. Now he's gone on to much bigger and better things.
What high school did you go to?
Huh?
What high school?
This is Near Israel in Baltimore, Maryland. So So the Star K takes the position that quinoa is perfectly okay for Pesach. The OU has gone back and forth. One year they say it's good, one year they say it's bad. I don't even know what they're up to today. I have to check.
So you eat it 1 year, and then the next year...
Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here. The Eda Charedes, the Badatz, which is the best kashrus organization in Israel, they just say it's no good. So if you're confused, what do you do? It is very, very confusing. I will tell you personally although I personally don't eat quinoa because I just don't eat it, but I would have no problem eating it, meaning to say I would be willing to tell you that as long as it has a generally reliable hashgacha, be sure about that. In other words, don't buy processed quinoa from an unsupervised company because it may have all sorts of other things in it. But quinoa is quinoa. You don't have to be strict on kidneys. It really, frankly, makes no sense logically to enlarge kidneys beyond its original range. So I would have no problem with quinoa. But if you're reading different opinions, the answer is there are different opinions, and even single organizations change their psak from year to year. Now, if you're asking me, though, if you wanted to follow the recent psak, could you eat last year's quinoa? The answer is no. I mean, when they say, in other words, when the OU says it's no good, they're saying it was never good. Now, last year they said it was good, but now they're saying it was never good. So it is confusing, but that's because, well, I'll tell you, particularly with the OU, the problem basically is the OU has two rabbis who are their final halakhic authorities. And one rabbi says it's good, and one rabbi says it's not good. Well, that's why the Gemara says you're not supposed to have an even number of judges. You have to have an odd number of judges, because when you have an even number of judges, you got a tie. And what do? Right? That's exactly the problem. That's why a basin is three. But for some reason, their poskim are two. their rabbis are two. So quinoa is a tie, right? And that's why. They're undecided. Okay? So that's a little bit just to know about kidney, is to familiarize yourself with it. Buckwheat is kidney, that's why there's no kosher lepesach kasha for Ashkenazim. Sfardim don't eat kasha, so they wouldn't have it, but theoretically, Sfardim could have kosher lepesach kasha. Yeah.
Can I go over medicine?
I will. I will go over the other topic too. Okay. Yeah.
Do you know what
kielbasa
is?
I forgot. I know what it is, but remind me.
What about a bean? Yeah.
Yes, right.
Is that
kidney? Yes, it is. Okay, but Sfardim can eat it. Okay, now let me move to the next topic. And the next topic is the status of medicine and cosmetics on Pesach.
Ooh.
Now, here you need to know the following problem. Obviously, number one, if you're dealing with serious conditions like high blood pressure, which, God forbid, can easily kill somebody, diabetes, don't fool around, meaning to say, whether it's chametz or not chametz, you don't worry about it. You take the medicine.
Prescriptions?
If it's, it depends. And it might be prescriptions for acne. You know, I mean, prescriptions are sometimes for minor conditions, but if it's something that's even potentially serious, you do not fool around with your health. Pikuach nefesh, saving your life, preserving your life, overrides any prohibition of chametz on Pesach. Okay. It is worth it if it's not too difficult. But the poskim even say that you shouldn't necessarily switch to a generic or an inferior brand because it may not have the same medical efficacy. Say again. It might be. In other words, you have to talk to your doctor. In other words, don't make a switch to what you think is an equivalent without talking to your doctor, because there may be information about medicines you're not...
Do you need
a psak?
Yeah.
You need a psak, because sometimes you might think something serious when it's not, but in truth, if you really, if you know this is a serious condition, you don't need to ask anybody.
Definitely, I gotta buy a new toothbrush and get a new toothpaste.
Right, I'll get to it. Let me just give me time to go in order. Okay. Now, let's assume, though, that you're not talking about, any life-threatening condition. So what is the chametz problem in medications, right? So in truth, it is very rare that the active ingredient, the actual drug, is chametz. The drug is fine. The drug is some chemical something. But with pills, the problem with pills is that pills have what is called a starch binder. There is a binder.
Capsules, not the non-capsules.
Well, it depends. A regular pill has a starch binder.
Right.
A capsule may not have a binder. A capsule may just be gel.
What's now, the binder then?
Let's take a Tylenol pill.
Oh.
A pill, not a capsule. The pill has starch. In fact, there's a test. Do you remember from chemistry? There's a test to determine starch. You put, what do you put on it? Is it iodine? You put something on it, and if it turns, changes
iodine,
color,
yeah.
changes color, that shows there's starch there, right? So here's the thing. Starch can have different origins. There can be wheat starch, which is chametz.
What did it say?
No, it does not say, because it's an inactive ingredient. It doesn't have to be listed. Okay, that's important. So, there can be wheat starch, which is real chametz. There can be corn starch, which is only kidneys. That's why I don't have a problem with it. Right, let's take those two. Those might be the two. Potato starch would be, right? So those are your three possibilities. Now, here is the thing.
It's wheat, potato, and
wheat, potato, corn.
Corn.
Now, here is the thing. If the worst you have is cornstarch, there's actually no problem at all, because since it's only kidneys, kidneys can be ingested for medicinal purposes. Okay? So cornstarch in pills is actually not a problem, but wheat starch in pills might be a problem. But let me discuss the halachic issue. There are some opinions that say there is never a chametz problem in pills. Now, again, I'm not getting to liquid yet. That'll be a separate issue. Reason? There is a certain principle in the laws of chametz that says the following. Even if something is chametz, if it's not edible by a dog, if a dog wouldn't eat it, it's no longer considered to be a food, and there's no prohibition of ingesting it. So the argument goes that typically in a pill, if you ever chewed... Now, again... I'm not talking about a chewable vitamin. I'll get to that because that'll be more complicated. But if you were to chew an aspirin pill, chew a Tylenol pill, you would discover very quickly that the taste is extremely bitter. It is not an...
I heard that a dog thing was a myth.
God forbid. Absolutely not. It is 1,000% true.
Where is it from?
It's from the Gemara.
Oh, wow.
It's not a made-up rule. The Talmud says, the Gemara says, in Pesachim.
Does that apply to vitamins as well?
I'll get to it. I have to go in order because there's so many questions you're going to have.
Okay.
Any chametz that is so bitter or spoiled that an animal wouldn't eat it, mentions a dog specifically, is no longer considered chametz. Therefore, Some have argued, I'll give you a psak later, some have argued that if the pill has cornstarch, it's only kidneys anyway, no problem even for Ashkenazim, because it's medicine. And even if it has wheat starch, which is chametz, since in a pill form it is so bitter, and it is bitter, it is so bitter, that, you know, you literally can't even swallow it that way. That's why you swallow it without chewing it, so you shouldn't have the bitter aftertaste. It is not something that even an animal would eat. That would make it permitted. So according to that view, pills never raise a halachic problem of chametz, because either the starch is kidneyos starch, which is permitted for medicine, or it's chametz that is pasul meaning inedible, by even an animal. Okay, and indeed you could rely on that psak, but you have to differentiate between pills like Tylenol, aspirin, Buferin, you know, pills, versus things like chewable vitamins, because chewable vitamins do have a taste. Right, they could taste like you give to a child, or even an adult can have a chewable vitamin. They can have an orange taste, they can have a strawberry taste, they can have a mint taste. Now, in chewable vitamins, since it is sweet enough that you can taste it, so the starch is going to be a problem. Now, again, if it's only kidneyos starch, it still wouldn't be a problem, because kidneyos is permitted for medicinal reasons. But if it's the wheat starch in a chewable tablet, it is a chametz problem. So how do you know if it's cornstarch or wheat starch? You really don't know. So that's why you need to get, and some of this is online, you need to get a guide. In other words, guides are put out, both in the United States and in Israel, listing which medications are chametz problems and which are not. So if you Google, I'm just going to give you a Google here, just Google list of kosher for Pesach medications. Now you might ask, well, if all I need is a list, why do you need you? You know, okay, well, I am useless indeed. But my point tonight is not to give you brands. I'm not going to sit here and read a list of 500 brands, but I want you to understand the concept of this, right? You understand the concept. The central concept is that for pills, the problem is the starch binder. And in many cases, the starch binder is kitnios, so there's no problem, even for Ashkenazim. It's only a minority of cases, it is wheat, which is real chametz. But if it's a non-chewable, you have the heter that it's not edible by a dog, so it's permitted. So you're only going to have a problem with pills when it is chewable, having a good taste, and the starch binder is wheat, oat, rye, spelt, or barley. Okay? Now, so therefore, the list will tell you what's okay, what's not okay. Now, let me just go on one more thing. Now, I've been talking about pills and vitamins. Let me talk about liquid medicines. Liquid medicines like cough syrup, number one, always have a flavor, basically, and the like, mouthwashes. Now here, the problem in them is alcohol. Alcohol is an ingredient in all cough syrups.
Now, even
if it's what?
It's really gross.
Yeah, a dog wouldn't eat alcohol.
Well, yeah, but a human would. That's the problem. There's the idea that a dog wouldn't eat, meaning...
No, but the flavored medicine, like, it's still...
Well, okay, let me discuss a little. Now, what is alcohol made out of? So this is important. There are many, many types of alcohol. A lot of alcohol is synthetic. Synthetic alcohol is not chametz at all. But if it says ethyl alcohol, E-T-H-Y-L, or ethanol, that is a grain-based alcohol. Now, sometimes it's made from corn, which is kidney, so you're okay, even for Ashkenazim. In a minority of cases, it's made from wheat. But there's a little bit of a trick here. Let me explain this. And that is, and then, by the way, this is the same, let me combine something. This is the same issue with deodorants and many cosmetics. Liquid cosmetics may have alcohol in them. Solid cosmetics like powders may have starch in them. Okay, so sometimes there's a starch problem. Sometimes there's an alcohol problem. But here's the thing. Have you heard of the concept of, have you ever seen something called... denatured alcohol. Do you know what denatured? It'll say DNA, which is not DNA, it's denatured alcohol. Here's the thing. Do you know that when you make alcohol for liquor or brandy, the government taxes it at a very, very high price. But when you make alcohol for let's say, cosmetics or other uses, the tax rate is much lower. But the government wants to be sure that you don't simply say that you're making the alcohol for cosmetics and then using it for liqueur. So they require that you put certain poisons or toxins in the alcohol so it no longer becomes suitable for human consumption, and then they tax you at the lower rate. That is called denatured alcohol. Denatured alcohol means alcohol that's not going into a food product in which there are toxins added. So there's a big, big machlokas. Many poskim take the position that denatured alcohol is by definition not edible by a dog because it's poison. And therefore, as a result, the alcohol in cosmetics is not chametz, because even if it's grain alcohol, it's been denatured. And that includes deodorant. In fact, I have a psak from Chicago here. What they say here is the following. I'll read it to you so you see a psak that I think you can follow. All varieties of blush, body soap, conditioners, creams, eyeshadow, eyeliner, face powder, foot powder, foundations, ink, lotions, mascara. Boy, it's hard to be a woman. Mascara, nail polish,
oh my God.
Ointment, paint, shampoo, and stick deodorant are permitted for use on Pesach.
Oh, I thought he was about to say they're not really.
No, are permitted. Not everybody would agree, but you could follow this Pesach. And the argument goes because it's not inherently not edible by a dog. So it's not a myth. This is a very important halacha. Or the alcohol has been denatured, so now it's toxic, and it's not edible by a dog. However, it does say that mouthwash and toothpaste, which directly go into your mouth, they're not denatured, because obviously they're not going to put poison in mouthwash. Okay, so be sure you understand this. Things that go into your mouth that have alcohol in them are potentially chametzdik, and therefore you need to check ingredients books to see whether it's okay. But the things you apply to your body generally have denatured alcohol, and it's not edible by a dog, and that is why it's going to be permitted, right? So this is a very important rule. Chametz that is not edible by an animal is no longer considered to be chametz. This is from the Gemara.
With chapstick on there?
Yes, so chapstick, let me just check this again here.
It's on your mouth sometimes.
So. Wait, so what are we supposed to do to find out?
Okay, so no. So again, if you have it, you have a computer. I mean, I can give you this information myself, but you know, I can give you a 20-page thing, but you can get it yourself. Meaning, Google something called cosmetics and medicines kosher for Pesach.
Yeah, now, is it going to tell me the brand?
Yes. So I'll tell you. If you go to the, and this is a posik that I know personally. If you go to the Chicago Rabbinical Council, you will see a 25-page list of actual brands of medicine and cosmetics that they have investigated and they have determined are kosher for Pesach.
Also Israeli brands like Akamai?
Well, no. They will not give you... There's no comprehensive international list that I'm aware of. In other words, you can get from the American organizations lists of American products, and you can get from Israel lists of Israel products. So just add to your Google search Israeli products, cosmetics and medicines.
I'm just not going to take any.
Well, okay. But again, I want you to understand the concept, okay? Do you understand the concept of what you're looking for, okay? Because once again, a lot of the ingredients are kitnios, which are permitted for medicines, although not for cosmetics, by the way. Theoretically, corn flour would not be permitted for cosmetics, but they are permitted for medicine. And then the other heter is that it's not edible by a dog, and that's why you got to be stricter, but things you actually put in your mouth, like mouthwash, and the like. Now, let me point out, so chapstick, you should be strict. Now, let me point out something else. There are other issues with cosmetics that are not connected to Pesach. That is, on Shabbos or Yom Tov, there are things you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to use chapstick or lipstick, you know, a solid lipstick on Shabbos, because, number one, you're coloring your face, which you're not allowed to do. And number two, you're also smoothing down a surface. So keep in mind, when we say something is kosher lePesach, that still means you got to consider the Shabbos and Yom Tov problems as well. They don't go away, even if something is certified for Pesach.
So yeah. Synthetic alcohol is okay, but ethanol alcohol is not okay in medicine.
That's correct. But on the other hand, if it's not edible by a dog, right. Okay? So if it says methanol, that's perfectly okay. If it says ethanol, that shows you it's chametz, but even then it might be kitnios, might be corn-based, but at least it's a possibility. If it just says alcohol and doesn't say either one, you have to err on the side of being strict, but then you have to apply these rules about denatured alcohol and everything else. Yeah.
So
So, going back to vitamins.
Yeah.
Like, normal, not chewable children's vitamins, like, if you just take a multivitamin every day.
Yeah.
Like, can you assume that it's kosher Pesach, or, like, I don't
know. It would be better to be strict, but technically, if it does have a very bitter taste. And it's not a chewable, so you could rely.
But if it's not like so important, like you should just.
If it's not so important, it's better to be. It is better to be strict.
Okay,
strict,
so would you need to get like a new medicine case if you put it in?
A new medicine case? No. You don't need a new medicine case. You just need to find a kosher Pesach substitute.
Right, but if you use that one for normal everyday, like all year round, and on Pesach, like would you have to get a different case for Pesach?
Just a case?
Like, Sunday, if you have Monday. Different medicines other than just your vitamins, do you need a separate case for those for Pesach?
Not necessarily. You just want to be sure there's no loose crumbs or whatever it is. But if it's a clean case, you could certainly use the same case. You never have to get a new case, really. You just want to be sure there's no loose... you don't get new cabinets either. You just clean your cabinets. I mean, people line their cabinets, but according to the strict halacha, at least... As long as you clean it, you don't have to line it, because as long as there's no crumbs there, you're perfectly fine. Okay, so again, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you brands. I mean, you'd be amazed how many brands of everything there is.
Well, trust me, I've been wearing it for a long time.
Well, maybe I should. My wife asked me many, many years ago to buy her a certain cosmetic thing when I was in a drugstore. And... I was totally lost. I mean, I saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stuff. I couldn't figure it out at all. So, but you'd be amazed in medicines, how many medicines there are. There are like thousands and thousands of medicines. So you really need a book. It wouldn't make sense for you just to read lists. But you can get the list. The lists are online. And I would recommend the Chicago Rabbinical Council because I know them to be very, very reliable. Yeah.
On mouthwash and toothpaste, it always says, like, warning, do not swallow... hazardous for your health, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So why isn't that considered inedible?
So there is actually an argument. In other words, the poskim argue about this a lot, meaning some poskim have argued that since mouthwash is not meant to be swallowed, and if it's swallowed, it might be even somewhat toxic, although moderately so, you're not going to die from swallowing mouthwash. And toothpaste as well is something you're supposed to spit out. So they have made the argument, even if it goes into your mouth, that doesn't make it edible, because something is edible only if it's swallowable, and that which is not meant to be swallowed is by definition not a food. According to those opinions, mouthwash and toothpaste, even if they contain alcohol, which is chametz, is absolutely kosher for Pesach.
Swallow a little bit.
Well, that's an accident, but still, it's not meant to be swallowed. So there is indeed many poskim that say exactly toothpaste does not have to be kosher lePesach. However, the tendency, as I indicated, has been to be progressively stricter in these matters, and they point out that as toothpaste and mouthwash have more and more flavorings and the like, they approach the line of food a little bit closer, and therefore, if you're asking what the proper behavior is, it's to get one that's kosher for Pesach. Now, I will tell you this. The one thing I do remember is that Procter & Gamble products, I think Scope is an example, they do not, Crest, they do not use alcohol in any of their products. And as a result, they are almost all kosher LePesach. Yeah, I believe so. But you have to check the list because things could change. I mean, I remember this from 4 years ago. That over the years, but you always have to check. But basically, a lot of companies, because of safety concerns and because of children, stop using alcohol in their products. And as a result, that also takes away the main chametz issue, because the main chametz issue is alcohol. I also want to point out that even a majority of the products that use alcohol, most is synthetic, because it's much, much cheaper than grain alcohol. So, if you're asking me, let's say I don't look at any list at all, and I just buy, cosmetics and stuff, what are the chances that I'm doing chametz? I'll be honest with you. The actual chance that you're transgressing chametz is really very, very small. If you look at these lists, you will see only like 1% of the products are really chametz. Oh. Because chametz is expensive, right? It's natural. Now, one thing that would be a problem is they have a brand name in the States, Avena. Avena, I think, is Avena. Now, Avena is Spanish for oat. These are things you put in bath and the like, and this is really oat flour that theoretically you could even eat, you know, if you wanted to, and the like. So a product like that you absolutely have to avoid.
Even though it's not edible?
Well, that's the question. In other words, it seems to be that they want to keep it so fresh and natural that it actually still might be edible, meaning some... I'll say again?
There's parabens in there.
What is paraben? What is that?
Chemicals, you know, estrogen.
Yeah, okay, there might be, but still, if a person were desperate, I mean, Rav Moshe Feinstein took the position that even sterno, you know what sterno? Sterno is, you know, you can cook, it's like this, it's
gooey.
Like alcohol that you can cook with, that Rav Moshe says he remembers drunks in Russia would drink it when they were desperate. So when a person would drink, you know, it could be anything. So, in fact, I had read that in Russia, where people drink a lot, you know, if people can't afford vodka, you know, they buy deodorants, they buy all sorts of things, and they drink it down.
College,
you know,
too.
So it's not so simple that something is not drinkable. Yeah.
What about like prescriptive medications? Like obviously not on Shabbos and Yantiv on Pesach, but what about the other days of Pesach? Like, what if they're prescriptive, like my acne medicine or something like that?
Are you asking a chametz problem or just a general chametz?
No, a chametz problem.
Well, it depends what it is, as I say.
I'm saying if you can't look on those places because those are like brand names. And yeah. I'm saying these are specific like medications.
Okay, and it's not chewable?
Like clindamycin. No, it's creams.
Okay, so it's going to be permitted, as I say. Let me just remind you again. I didn't read you the medication. It says over here... All pill medications are permitted. This is a psak of the Chicago. The creams would be permitted as well. And again, the reason is because the creams are not fit for even animal consumption. So you don't have to worry about them.
Right. My dogs like creams.
Your dog likes creams?
Yeah, they
do. They won't stop. So you couldn't.
That's an interesting question. So what happens if you have a dog that likes this stuff?
Dog food, they didn't
want to
eat it, so it's like, well, it's weird.
Okay, I think we follow the average dog. We don't look at each particular dog.
Yeah.
Huh?
Cosmetics.
Yeah. So the theory. Well. In truth, as I say. That's why the cosmetics would be permitted. I mean, that was the bottom line. But the reason why some people are strict is they claim the following. The alcohol was originally edible. It was then denatured when it was put in the cosmetics, you see? So the argument goes that denatured alcohol can be easily restored by a chemical process to become potentially edible. And this is what alcoholics do. They know actually how to remove the denaturing. So the argument about cosmetics is whether denatured alcohol right now is inedible, but it could be rendered edible or drinkable. Would that affect it?
But the powder, they said starch was the problem.
Yes. No, because the starch, the difference is, well, the difference basically is this. The reason is that once the starch has been rendered bitter and inedible, it cannot be restored. Liquid alcohol has a particular process where you can burn off the denatured toxins. That's the difference. In other words, the difference is the starch in a pill, once it's ruined, it is permanently ruined. The denatured alcohol is technically restorable, and that's why some poskim are stricter with liquid cosmetics than they are with solid creams and the like, but some are lenient on both, indeed.
And stuff could be absorbed into your skin?
Well, yes, but once again, even though it's absorbed into the skin, it's not edible. In other words, chametz is correlated with what is edible. Absorbable is not the same as edible.
Can you find kosher toothpaste in
the store? Yes, absolutely. Now, of course, like everything else, kosher Pesach products are more expensive. because they stick you because you're stuck. You got to buy from them so they can charge whatever they want. But as I say, there are every year-round brands that are kosher. For example, Crest is kosher LePesach. Regular Crest is kosher LePesach. So you can get special Jewish, you know, Haredi toothpaste, whatever it would be. But many regular brands are kosher LePesach. Yes. But again, well, this is what I remember 4 years ago. Even if it doesn't say kosher LePesach, in other words, you'll see on product lists that certain types of cosmetics can be used without a hechsher because they don't contain alcohol, or the alcohol is considered to be not fit for an animal consumption.
You don't even need a hechsher on
things? For those things, you don't even need
glycerin.
A
hechsher. Wait, so what's in crust that
glycerin?
Well, glycerin is not a chametz problem. Glycerin is a kosher problem.
So it's not, okay.
Yeah, so that's a general issue with medicine.
If it's kosher, it has glycerin in it.
Well, if you could take it during the year, you can take it on Pesach. Glycerin is not a kosher problem. It's not a Pesach problem. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
Does it have to be a brand new tube, or can it be a...
Yeah, so that's another issue. This is an important issue. Even if you have a kosher LePesach medicine, which most are, a kosher LePesach cosmetic, or a kosher LePesach lotion or cream, and it's all kosher LePesach, it is better to get a new, fresh container.
Oh, for real?
For Pesach. At least for something like toothpaste, simply because, obviously, with toothpaste, there's stuff in your mouth that could get into things and whatever it would be. And therefore,
That wouldn't apply to prescription?
No, it wouldn't apply to prescription. I don't think you have to be extra strict for that. But generally speaking, products that you use... which, when chametz is around, you should get new ones. Same thing for everything. For example, I'll give you an example. Let's say you had a bottle of water. And you had half a bottle. Can I use it for Pesach? Well, it's better not to, really, because, you know, in the course of the year, you pour it, there might be chametz around. So that's just a pragmatic concern, that even if something is... A box of matzah. If I have a box of matzah that's kosher LePesach, that was already opened and used before, it's better not to use it during Pesach because it may get mixed up. So that's a general rule. Once you try to get a new toothbrush for Pesach, because obviously the toothbrush can have particles of foods, right? So new toothbrush every Pesach, new tube of toothpaste, etc. Yeah.
Okay, sorry, the dog food, what is, you said it's not kosher if it's inside. I mean, you have to have kosher dog food?
Yeah, that's important.
But what
yeah.
if... The dog food is outside the house in the backyard.
Okay, let me talk about that a little bit, because dog food or pet food, any pet food, is a real big problem. And that is, here's the problem. The prohibition of chametz on Pesach doesn't only apply to you eating chametz. You are not allowed to feed chametz to your animals. If I own a pet, I am not allowed to give my pet chametz on Pesach. So we have a real problem here. Some animal, well, it's not that a dog eats bread. That's not the issue so much. Dogs don't eat bread. But on the other hand, dog food normally contains a lot of grain filler. The meat is either beef or horse meat sometimes, but beef. Of course, it's not kosher, but that's not a problem. Giving my animal non-kosher meat is not a problem.
Really?
Yeah, non-kosher meat. Yeah, that's permitted. Otherwise, you can never give any dog food. All dog food is non-kosher. Meat. But the problem on Pesach is that there is grain that's a filler. Now, if it's corn, it's once again kidneyos, and you can give kidneyos to your animal, even if you're Ashkenazi. Okay? But if it's wheat, you got a problem. So even if the dog is outside of the house, you cannot feed your dog dog food. Now, what some people do is they sell their dog to a guy. For the same way you sell your chametz to a guy,
what?
They sell their dog to a guy for Pesach? No, it cannot. But if you sell the guy, you have to give it to the non-Jew for Passover. Yeah. Now, the best thing to do is to get your dog on a Pesach Dika diet. You could start before Pesach. Meat, again, you know, fresh meat. Table scraps. I know that you're not supposed to give a dog table scraps because then they get spoiled and everything else. But give your dog table scraps for a week. Of course, he'll never go back to dog food after that. and keep him on a kosher LePesach diet. Because unless you want to get rid of him for all of Pesach, you will not be allowed to give chametz to him, even if you sell the dog to a goy technically. Okay, so that's what you have to do. Same thing with hamsters and with cats and with fish. Fish is sometimes a problem because fish only eat certain things. Some fish meal is chametz, mamish. And it's edible by animals, at least.
Hamsters
don't. They don't eat grain. They only eat seeds. Okay, well, whatever it is. In other words, again, if you're not giving him grain, you don't have a problem. But if you're giving him grain, there's going to be a problem.
Okay, weird question.
Yep.
So I have a fish at home, and it's been on my aunt's, like, all year long.
Yep.
Is that considered her fish, or do I have to sell it?
I'm sorry, it's not your fish. It belongs to somebody else?
No, it's my fish, but I left it at home for a year.
Well, and the fish eats chametz, you mean? The fish food is chametz.
Her husband is non-Jewish. You're a fish person?
And it's in their house.
It's in their house.
It's in the house of a man that is not Jewish.
Bride.
Well, but you if you make it clear that you're giving it to them, yeah, you do have to sell it, yeah. Otherwise, it's still yours. In other words, the fact that it's in the house of a guy is not enough of a heter.
So
unless
when I'm selling all my stuff, I have that in mind when I'm selling stuff in America as well, and then just have him feed it?
That's correct. That's correct.
I tried to feed him matzo last year. He didn't like it.
Yeah, it is a problem. I actually read there is a problem with fish. Fish are finicky, apparently. And you can't, you know, you can't really switch from breadcrumbs to matzo or something else. So you have to figure out, you have to, again, this is an important issue because it absolutely is usher to give chametz to your pet on Pesach.
One has to. Is
worm
considered chametz?
No, worm is not. Worm is fine. Worm is not chametz. Worm is not. Chametz is only the five grains. Even kidneys. Remember again, even though I as an Ashkenazi cannot eat corn or rice or buckwheat, I can feed it to my animals. So even kidneys is not chametz for purposes of feeding animals. Okay. So everyone has the general idea. Let me just yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Like, why you can't let your dog do things for you on Shabbos that are
anti-Shabbos? No, it's somewhat of a different principle. The principle is that chametz is not only prohibited to eat, it's also prohibited to get benefit from as long as it's edible chametz. That's why if it's not edible, you can get benefit. That's the cream. But edible chametz, you cannot even get a benefit from. You couldn't, for example, give chametz as a gift to your next-door non-Jewish neighbor on Pesach because you're getting the benefit of his gratitude. So feeding your pet is a form of benefit from chametz. And chametz is forbidden to have benefit. That's the idea behind that. Now, again, though, I do want to emphasize that the issur of benefit is only if the chametz is edible. That's why the taking the medicine, the creams, and the like, even though you're getting benefit, but if it's not edible by the animal, then it's permitted. But edible chametz, you cannot even get benefit from. Okay, are there any other questions about this? Because I did one final thing I do want to mention. This. It's a little question, but one needs to be sensitive to this, about time zones. Oh, actually, I two more things I want to mention. Right. I'm going to have to be relatively quick. Those of you that are going to America, right, so you know that you're 7 hours earlier than here.
Depends where you
that
are.
That means, okay, where are we? Okay, I have my East Coast prejudice. Yeah, you're correct. What I mean is the following. When you're observing Pesach in one place and you have your chametz in another place, let's say you still have chametz here in Israel and you're in New York for Pesach, the concept is, you are not allowed to own chametz at the earlier of the two points. By that I mean to say the following. In Israel, let's just use New York and Israel as an example. You can extrapolate to Chicago and California and the like. Let's say, if in Israel it's chametz 7 hours earlier, you are not allowed to own chametz when it's Pesach in Israel, even though it's not yet Pesach in America. Now, what that means practically is the following. When you go to a rabbi, as I assume you will do, and you will ask the rabbi to sell your chametz, be sure to tell him that you have chametz in Israel, because the chametz in Israel will have to be sold 7 hours earlier than the chametz in America, because it'll be Pesach in Israel 7 hours earlier than the Chametz in America. Now, the same thing is true by the buying back, that since it'll be Pesach in America for another 7 hours, the Chametz will not be repurchased till more than 7 hours after Pesach is over in Israel. So, consequently, a rabbi must be informed, it's very important, about all the different time zones in which you have Chametz, because the sale has to be correlated with when Pesach, actually it's not Pesach, when the prohibition of Erev Pesach Chametz, right, kicks in, okay? So that's an important thing to be aware of. Yeah.
What if, like at home, I live in a back house, so do I have to do a separate one besides my parents? Like, do they have to fill one out for me too?
Yes, if you, in other words, if you own Chametz and you have a separate residence, you have to,
I mean, it's on the same property, but it's not connected.
Well, still, but you're the owner of it, right? I mean, I don't mean the house, but you're the owner of the Chametz.
In my room.
Yes.
Yeah, so my room is not connected to the house.
No, that's fine, but you have to sell your Chametz, right?
Yeah,
you could do it. You could do it, or they could do it, whatever it is. But you have to make them an agent, a shaliach, to do it for you.
Do roommates have to separately sell their Chametz?
Say again?
Do roommates have to separately sell their Chametz?
Yes. Yes, they should, because if you own separate property. Now, yeah.
If you have two different houses in the same time zone, do you have to specify, or can you say all my property in the state?
Well, even then they'll ask you to specify, but it's less significant, less important there. The reason, but where it's two different time zones, the rabbi has to know exactly.
What if it's three?
Three time zones? Yes. Well, he has to know all the time zones. Yeah.
Restaurants that are kosher, we could trust them, like they're open during Pesach.
You're talking about the ones in Israel?
Yeah.
So the only thing I would be, well, number one, it has to be a hashgacha that you would trust during the year. In other words, there are many hashgachot that you would not trust during the year. You're certainly not going to trust them on Pesach. Mm-hmm. But if it is the type of supervision that you would use during the year, you can trust them on Pesach, provided you verify that it's a kitnios-free menu, because some of them might only be for Svardim, and kitnios would be a problem if you're an Ashkenazi. But other than that, you can rely on whatever is reliable during the year. Now, let me just mention one final point in which Chabad makes life much, much easier for you. No, I wasn't going to. Gebrucks makes it harder. I was going to mention another thing. I was going to mention, I'll mention two things real quick. One is, what is the status? You know, in Chutz La'aretz, you keep 2 days of the holiday. First day, second day, two seders. In Eretz Yisrael, you keep 1 day. Perennial issue is, well, what if I live in Israel and I'm visiting America? What if I live in America but I'm in Israel for a year? Do I keep 2 days, 1 day? It's a very, very complicated question. There are svarim, I have a sefer, 600 pages. Going over all of this. Let me just tell you, though, Chabad has a simple rule. Chabad's rule is, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. In other words, according to Chabad, right, when you are in Israel, you're a one-day person. That means, however, when you're in America, you're a two-day person. Now, that is a... No. That's something. Chabad's view is...
Elat does 2 days, yeah. Though, no?
Huh?
Elat is 2 days.
Elat is not called part of Israel. Now, let me just say that a majority of the Jewish poskim make a much more complicated question, and that is, it depends where you plan on living, and that's a very complicated issue. Yeah. Meaning, if I'm in Israel, but I'm planning on going back to America, I got to keep 2 days, but if I'm...
Is that like Purim where your plans matter?
Yeah, your plans matter. Yeah, your plans matter. Unlike Purim. You can change them later, but if you're not intending on living here permanently. But I just want to say, we don't have time to get into the complexities. It is a very fascinating question. But the Psak of the Alter Rebbe was, and many Sfardim follow this too, the Psak of the Alter Rebbe was, we don't care what your plans are. We don't care what your future plans are. We simply look at where you will physically be spending the Yom Tov. Now, that is a very easy rule to apply. Very easy rule to apply. It means, when you are here, you act like an Israeli, and when you are there, you act like an American. But I just want to warn you that you will see many, many, many religious Jews who do not follow that, and that is because many other poskim do not adopt that rule. But yeah, but I know this because simply because most of the Jewish world does not follow the Pesach, but this is the Alter Rebbe's Pesach. Yeah.
Can you follow the Chabad custom and keep one day and then eat kidneyot at your Sephardi?
Well, no. The answer is yes, but not for your reason. The reason you could is because many Sephardim independently have that Pesach, not because of the Alter Rebbe. This is actually the Pesach of many Sephardim, Ravadi Yosef and the like. So, in point of fact, Sephardim have both of those benefits, kidneyos and keeping one day. Now, one other thing. One place where the Alter Rebbe makes life a little harder for you, right, so he gives you the benefit of not having to keep 2 days in Israel, although you have to keep 2 days in America, is the idea of Gebrux. Now, Gebrux is Yiddish, and the Hebrew for Gebrux is Sheruyah.
What?
Sheruyah. Sheruyah means soaked matzah. And let me just explain very, very quickly what the background is, and that is the following. We know that when water and flour come together and 18 minutes elapse, you got this awful thing called chametz.
Hey!
Right? Can't have it. However, once something is fully baked, it can't become chametz anymore because that kills the enzymes that would enable fermentation. So as a result, according to the law of the Gemara, once I have a baked piece of matzah, I could make knedlich, I could make matzah balls, I could make all sorts of things, because once it's baked, it can never become chametz. But the Alter Rebbe introduced a chumrah. He didn't invent it. I mean, there were earlier sources, but he felt very strongly that since you're never 100% sure if your baking process is complete, we have to be afraid that if any liquid touches even a baked matzah product, it might possibly become chametz because it was not completely baked. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a chumrah that, of course, Chabad has, but also many, many Hasidim have. It's not only Chabad. In fact, almost all Hasidim have a chumrah. Now, that means that they will not make a matzah ball because matzah ball is matzah meal in hot soup. Some will not even put butter or margarine or jelly on matzah. They're machmir, they treat that as a liquid of fermentation. This is called the chumrah of gebrux. Now, linguistically, it's a little confusing. When a person says, I keep gebrux, it's not clear exactly what that means. Mm-hmm. That means I eat. You have to differentiate. If I say I eat gebrux, that means I don't keep gebrux. Mm-hmm. You have to be very careful. Sometimes people get mixed up. I eat gebrux means I eat wet matzah. If I eat wet matzah, I don't keep the custom of avoiding Sharia. Okay? It's very confusing when people talk. So if you mean to say you keep the Alter Rebbe's chumrah, you say, I don't eat gebrux, or I keep gebrux. Okay? If you mean I eat gebrux, then you either say I eat or I don't keep gebrux. Okay? You have to be sure you have the lingo correct. Now, what is very interesting about this is that the Alter Rebbe himself says this is only an extra stringency for Pesach, and as a result, on the eighth day of Pesach in the diaspora, which is only a rabbinic Pesach, you are allowed to have gebrux. And that is why at the famous last meal escorting the holiday, which is called the meal of Mashiach or the meal of the Baal Shem Tov, they do serve matzah balls there. Okay? So that's only relevant in Eretz Yisrael. There's no day like it. In Eretz Yisrael, we don't have an eighth day. So if you have the custom of keeping gebrux, not eating Sharia, then you can't have any matzah balls on Pesach. Yeah.
Good. What if you give it and eat it in the
back? Again, even less than 18 minutes because it's similar to kidneys. In other words, in a way, it's stricter than we would normally apply. Okay? So, gebrux, so don't confuse gebrux and kidneys. Kidneys is an absolute obligation for Ashkenazim. Gebrux is a minhag that is kept by the Alter Rebbe, by Chabad, but of course not just Chabad. Many, many, many Hasidim keep the minhagim of gebrux. And most kosher Pesach hotels today, not for spiritual reasons, but they want to attract as much business as they can. Most of them will keep Gebrek. They will
restaurants
not,
and will keep Gebrek?
Yes, yes, really? Yes. Oh, yeah, the reason is because otherwise they're not going to get business. I mean, a restaurant has to look at what will attract the most tourists, so they have to have a menu.
Wow.
That tourists are going to go to.
So if you say
to.
You keep non-gebrucks, does that mean you don't eat gebrucks or you do eat gebrucks?
No. If you keep, well, actually, there's no phrase like that. You made up the phrase. But if you say, I keep non-gebrucks, I mean, that's like saying, I keep non-chalav Yisrael. I mean, you know, you don't really say, I keep non-chalav Yisrael. But you're correct. If you say, I keep non-gebrucks, that means you eat gebrucks. That's right.
That's
keeping non-gebrucks the same as eating gebrucks, right? Yeah.
Actually, even
the comments
is so, like, wouldn't
Gebrucks
be a good fence around that?
Yes, yes. I mean, it makes sense. You know, I'm not... Well, you know, once again, there's a balance here, because there is a mitzvah to enjoy Yom Tov, right? So to say, I can't have a matzah ball, you know, we are reluctant to restrict people in terms of what they could enjoy on Yom Tov. Let me just end with one very, very quick thought, a little non-halachic thought. You know, we know matzah, good, chametz, bad. And let me just say very, very quickly, I'm sure you probably heard a lot of this, but three little thoughts about matzah and chametz. What makes chametz so bad? So the most famous reason is chametz is puffed up and arrogant, and matzah is flat. So chametz is arrogance, conceit, ego. And that keeps me away from Hashem. And when I have humility and humbleness, I connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's reason one. Reason number two is that chametz is inertia. Because if water hits flour and you do nothing, it turns into chametz. Chametz is automatic. Matzah, you have to do something. You have to bake it. And it reminds us that our job in life is not to sit around and waiting for things to happen. But we have to seize the opportunities to come close to Hashem. And the third idea of chametz and matzah is chametz spoils. Right? Bread eventually gets moldy, spoils. It gets worse and worse. Matzah never spoils. It's an amazing thing. In fact, I believe that we've discovered matzah from Masada.
What?
A 2,000-year-old matzah.
It's good.
And you could still eat it. I mean, some people feel that was their shmur matzah last year. It was like, tasted like Masada. I mean, it gets hard, but it doesn't get rotten. It doesn't get rotten. And therefore, that's the concept. That when there is humility, there is eternal life. You don't spoil. You don't disintegrate. With arrogance, all there is spoilage and rot. Right. So three ideas. Chametz is arrogance. Chametz is inertia. And chametz is rot and spoilage. Okay? And Be'ezus Hashem, I wish you all a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, a very sweet Pesach. And Chazal tell us, in Nisan was the redemption, and in Nisan there will be the redemption.
Amen.
May the month be a Shana of Gula.
Amen.
Okay.
You too, Rabbi.
Yeah, baby.